Hello.
Hey, Kabir.
Hey.
Hey,
Yeah. How are you? Who's this?
good. This is Josh calling from 1-800 BJJ Help. How's it going?
Dude, amazing. Happy to hear from you.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you on the hotline here for some help along this journey. But first, could you give me our and our listeners just a quick intro of who you are, your jiu-jitsu journey a little bit, and yeah, we'll start from there.
Yeah, absolutely. So my name is Kabir Bath. I run a school just outside of Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, called Kaboom BJJ. I'm a black belt under Rafael Lovato Jr. I've been training for 18 years, coaching for 17 years, and running my own academy for the last 12 years.
Awesome. And I've heard of you because of the recent coaching conversations that you've been putting out on YouTube and now on audio form as well on different podcast platforms. And so you're actually the first person that I reached out to who's kind of been talking a lot about this ecological approach. And I'm really excited to pick your brain a bit. I bought some mats. So I have like a 10 by 10 set of mats at home now for maybe a month. And I've been having some friends over from the gym, and we've literally just been playing Greg Sauter's Instagram reels and playing those games. We've been playing the standing game that Greg critiqued of yours on his video. So that's been fun. And yeah, so I'm just starting to dip my toe into it. Jake has been teaching at his school in Hawaii for how long now, Jake?
It's been a while. You asked me this the other day, and I was trying to retrace it, but probably about a year.
So yeah, Jake's been doing all eco games at his school for about a year now in Lanai. So he's got a lot more experience than me, but we both are curious to learn more about game design and all that. But to take a step back, for those if they haven't heard about ecological dynamics or constraint-led approach yet, could you describe what those two things are?
Man, yes, for sure. I mean, when it comes to like ecological dynamics, right, we're looking at just a theory of like learning in some ways, right? The other model would be like, hey, you're going to build up a mental model of how you're going to interact with this thing. And then as you're engaged in the thing, you're calling on those things, right? Whereas ecological dynamics is more of like direct perception. So the thing that is happening in front of me is sort of influencing or helping me, you know, that's my data. That's what I'm looking at. That's what sort of leading me through, and like the worst scientific definition possible, but the broad idea, right? One is, hey, we're reading, recalling something, you know, we have a little bit of loading time, then we apply. The other is, it is a constant engagement, right? Action and perception are like always happening at the same time. You can't disconnect those. When it comes to the constraints-led approach, hey, that's going to sort of use this overarching idea to help design practice activities, right? So you have the task, you have environment, you have, you know, just thinking of how do we manipulate those things to really make certain behaviors emerge or help really just get people more focused in on certain things that they really need to. Yeah, and for me, it's been super exciting to play with and just really see it. And for us, we have like a lot of different experiences. So we do it with 5-year-olds and we do it with 55-year-olds in our school, you know? Yeah, I mean, sure, everyone is by now. If you're on the internet, you've been assaulted by all the eco content in the world. If people preaching the holy gospel or whatever, I'm not that hardcore on like shoving the science down your throat, but we can apply it, we can figure out, we can troubleshoot.
Awesome. What do you think is the most common misconception about eco and constraint-led approach?
Yeah, that I no longer coach and I just say play this game and then I'm on Instagram looking at less impressed, more involved or whatever, you know, like that's what people assume happens falsely in some ways, right? Or they assume that we just let them continue to make repetitive mistakes or like, you know, or yeah, I'd say that's probably one of the biggest things I hear a lot. You know, and then there's all the criticism. Hey, why would you make them reinvent the wheel? I'm not making them reinvent the wheel. I'm choosing to just target them, you know, somewhere that I know they'll find and figure out and find those little like the soft skills of jiu-jitsu.
Right. And then is it true that you heard Greg Sauter's on a podcast and then that night you were like, we're going full eco and then you haven't looked back since? Is that what happened or did I get that wrong?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, pretty like I'll back up a little bit. So COVID life happened. I started thinking way more about coaching. I had already been pretty deep in the space and I realized there was a lot more games-based stuff and like scholastic sports that youth were playing. So my program for the youth side was already like 70% small-sided games, things of that nature. Adults hadn't got there quite yet. But yeah, I spoke with Greg in the afternoon from like 1 to 2 p.m. And then by like 7 p.m. that night, we had flipped all the adult things. And initially, I just like decided I'm going to do a 4-week block. I'll just try and run as many sessions in this way and see what happens. Yeah, so I just went for it. It's the only way I try and do stuff. Otherwise, I can't really evaluate it. It's just my thought process.
Right. Do you remember how it went that night?
Oh, yeah. Honestly, for my group at first, like, wow, it's just, I probably still have like the first lesson plan somewhere because I actually have like meticulous records of like every lesson plan. But if I can recall, it probably went pretty good. We did, and I actually know what we did a little bit. We did a lot of the passing games about getting past the line of the feet, holding the knee line, sort of those things. And I think we also did stuff off rear strangles. So we were setting them up in situations where they could sort of focus on the importance of the hand fight and just little things like that.
Gotcha. And then could we double click a little bit more into those 4 weeks? What were some of the first challenges you started to run into? Yeah. And did you start designing your own games at that point, or were you kind of borrowing from different coaches?
So when it came to my initial game design, I did pretty much all of them right off the jump, because there still wasn't like, I don't think Greg had put out like a Instagram reel yet. I just heard his Primal MMA podcast, which like dropped on like August 20th or something. And I was talking to him like 3 days later, you know what I mean? So I don't know how far he got with that. So I was just trying to like deconstruct like my favorite sort of like exchanges that I thought were super valuable. I'd watch like a Gordon Danaher thing, like, what could I create practice wise to make these things sort of happen on their own? And as far as initial challenges, truthfully, in the beginning, none, because like your students come in, they're like, oh, sick, we're just doing a bunch of live training. That is awesome. And like, one thing I've never done is like, through science at my students, I've never used the word like affordance or anything like that in class, or even like when I train my coaches on running sessions or give them guidance on that. Like, I see the value, but it didn't make sense there. So it was really smooth for us because, yeah, they were just stoked, you know. And yeah, it also wasn't like I came in, I was like, well, we're going to try something new. And I didn't like present it in some way. I just came in and we just hit the ground like running.
Right. So for those coaches that you're training, or if you talk to other coaches who are just starting to adopt this for the first time, what do you think are some of their most common challenges?
Hey, one quick note before we jump in. You know, on the show, we always talk about how we should train with intention and we should show up to class with a goal in mind of something that we're working on. But one challenge with that is that we don't really have a lot of control over what's being taught when you walk into class. So for example, last week I could go to a class and they could be teaching details to finish an armbar or how to do a Kimura. But we're all at different stages in our journey. And for me as a beginner, I know right now I should be prioritizing defense. So like pin escapes, guard retention. And so that's why we're really excited to announce that we actually landed our dream sponsor for this podcast. And it's SubMeta. If you haven't heard of SubMeta, it's a learning platform for jiu-jitsu. And I've actually been using it for a couple months now, and I really like how easy it is to use. It's organized and it's structured in a way to help us build a well-rounded game and start to take our learning into our own hands. So there's dozens of courses on there. They're organized by skill level, or you can deep dive into specific topics like back takes, leg locks, open guard for gi, for no gi. Right now, I'm partway through the foundations course. And I really like how there's bite-sized videos. They're like 5 minutes, 10 minutes long with little quizzes in between them to help me reinforce my learning. The platform is only $25 a month. And when you use the code BJJHELP, you get $16 off your first month. So it'll only cost you $9 if you want to try it out for a month. So that's SubMeta, SubMeta.io. And the code is BJJHELP to get $16 off your first month. Go ahead and check it out. The link is in the description and let us know how it goes.
Most commonly is, I would say the one thing that happens a lot is like, okay, so how do I teach them to do this specific thing using this method, right? And that's like where most people want to start. And it's a totally fine place to start, right? So you'll see a lot of people who like, and even Greg himself, when I was talking with him, he like shared this, like, you know, we all sort of started with the idea of like a regression of a technique working back. Hey, we're going to start in an end stage knee cut. We already got great control of the shoulders. Our knee is already like in that little hip pocket and we're playing from there. Then we did a regression out to, hey, we're at a knee line and we're trying to achieve the same goal. You know, I think that is one thing that many people do, which is totally fine. And I'm not hard on like, you know, that's a great idea or a bad idea, but it's just one of those things. But then like, there's other things. Oh, how do I teach mount escapes now? Or how do I teach this very particular thing? I had one of my like mentor guys like, hey, how do you teach butterfly elevation into cross ashi? I'm like, well, that's not like what I would target the lesson plan on. My lesson plan would be on like, you know, creating elevation to get access to the legs, whatever that looks like, you know, or things like that. So I think that can be one of the first challenges is just really thinking of it like I want a particular move to emerge. We really just want them to like have a certain set of skills and like the ability to like problem solve and less identify. Another problem I can see a lot of is they feel like they have to super prepare and like outline, which is like it's totally valid, but then sometimes what happens is you just do the same thing where you drop a whole bunch of knowledge on someone about everything that's important in this exchange, and you know you want to consider A, B, C, D, and let me tell you about the theory of feet and knees now suddenly, and push pull and like you just drop a bunch of knowledge on them, and then you're like, okay, and now play this game, and you've already melted their brain, right? But you're like, aha, I didn't show them, didn't make him dead drill, mission accomplished. You know, I would say that is probably the second most common thing. And it's just part of the curve though, right? Because one thing, and I'm not sure if you've experienced this, Jake, is you have to be way more conscious of your language, right? And how am I going to communicate this thing in the simplest terms that can really help, you know, focus on the right things. And I think part of that challenge with language is your understanding of grappling has to be a little bit different suddenly, you know, because I have a lot of people like, oh, you know, when I'm passing half guard, you know, I never really thought of what effect I'm creating. I'm just, you know, the traditional, oh, you know, thinking of when we get to half guard, we force to mount or we create a cut or whatever, you know? So I found that is the other sort of challenge that sometimes can happen there. It's like, how do I deconstruct grappling into like what is really going on rather than just technique A, B, C, because a lot of jiu-jitsu stuff and the way it's presented and communicated, when we see like great curriculum, it's like, okay, everything is an awesome decision tree, you know, and it's da 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 da, you know. I think that can be another sort of challenge there,
right? That decision tree, is that kind of under the information processing, like our brain's kind of like a computer? If this happens, we have three options here, and if those things happen, it expands.
Exactly. Yeah. And right. In real life, everyone just gets caught at the loading screen, right? They're like, okay, cool, some stuff is supposed to happen here and nothing has happened, you know, like right. It happens all the time.
Whereas ecological dynamics or constraint-led approach seems to be creating athletes where we put them in a situation so they can adapt over and over and over again from that situation. Is that kind of a good description?
Yeah. I mean, if we think of like one of the simplest sort of benefits, and the reason why I think a lot of people like it, is you get so much feedback on one little exchange because I get to like touch it over and over and over, win or lose. Whereas like if we just do a full guard pass round, right? Which is the sort of thing like, hey, isn't it just situational sparring? Can be, cannot be, right? But if you think of it's how do we guide the drill? How do we set it up? Why are we setting it up in this way? Right. The goal should be you want them to get touches on something. It doesn't have to be the same thing, but on the hand fight here, or the fight for inside position, or the fight for this or whatever, you know? And because you give them so much of that, I find what happens with our students is they're really active. And it doesn't mean they're just like moving for movement's sake, but you can see they're searching. They're looking like, this isn't here. That means I should try and do this because I know I have to keep their hips controlled right now. You know, and that's been a thing I just observe in the way that they train is really different.
Right. Can you give me an example of, so for the standing position, this is something that I'm pretty new at, and really the game that you had that Greg critiqued where one person tries to keep the inside tie and the other person tries to strip mm-hmm. those ties and get to a body lock or rear body lock, I think. So we've been playing that game a lot. And then last night, my buddy and I decided to try to invent our own game for the first time. And we were like, okay, how about if we just get a 2-on-1, we win. And within like a minute, we realized like I had a 2-on-1 grip on him while he had a 2-on-1 grip on me. And we were like, shit, I think we broke the game. Can you critique that game for me? And then maybe we can dive into a little more concrete examples of workshopping. Like, how would we go about getting better at creating games?
Cool. So run me through, how did you like explain the game? What were the parameters? Like,
So we would start, standing and we decide we'll start disengaged. And then both of our goals were the same. We're going to try to grab any 2-on-1 grip. And if we got to the 2-on-1 grip, I think we said we had to hold it for like 3 seconds, then we would win. Mm-hmm. And we played for like a minute or two. And then we found a position where I had a 2-on-1 and he had a 2-on-1 at the same time on me. And we were like, okay, I think we broke the game. Let's try something else.
Yeah. So sometimes with stuff like that, you know, you can have that. I haven't encountered that exact sort of slice. You know, that's an interesting thing. The double 2-on-1 just turns to like a do-si-do. So sometimes that stuff is just really, how are you going to find which one of you would have the winning 2-on-1? It's probably the one with the top hand on like the wrist or whatever, right? Because that would be something where maybe for that, it's just your definition of what the win condition has to be. Because a 2-on-1, like that could be anything. Is a 2-on-1, two hands on your wrist? Is a 2-on-1 wrist and elbow, arm draggy style? Is a 2-on-1 wrist and being outside the elbow, more of like what you might call like a Russian tie, right? So you just want to think of like what that might be. And in that situation, it would probably be as simple as you saying you have two hands on them and they have one or less on you, right? And that could have been enough to just help you clear that out, because obviously you're not going to stick to your 2-on-1 if they have it on them, because that's not a win. So you're going to have to disengage and play those things. So I think sometimes it's just being really particular in what does the win look like and what does that sort of entail. So that would probably be my initial adjustment. Other things is like, I think sometimes, you know, playing offense defense roles can be really effective, just because you can sort of have each person be focused on something a little bit different, and you'll get a lot more touches of just getting that to happen the first time. Whereas, you know, right now, you know, you're also acting and defending, maybe that's a lot, right? So then you guys just end up in sort of not a stalemate necessarily, but you sort of just get yourself like stuck.
Right. Yeah. Which is exactly what happened. And then we kind of just threw out the whole game, but still trying to workshop things like that. Earlier you mentioned that curve of like slowly, it seems like getting better at creating these games and starting with maybe in the beginning, people start with the end state and then just mm-hmm. take one step back from there. Could you give a few other examples of those types of games and maybe other types of games that might be a good place for people to start?
Yeah, I would say, like an easy way to think sometimes like game creation is like when I think of how do I want to scale this for my room or whether the material is like new to the students, is I'll play along like a continuum of connection, right? If it's really new as a skill for one player, we're going to really try and start it where you have the most advantages in terms of basic things like connection, angle, height, or like good stance versus bad stance type of stuff, right? So let's see, what did I do last night? So like last night, for example, you know, I've been really trying to work on our wrestling with our team, sort of like the most recent focus. So we did a session, you know, first sort of game when we really dove in is I started one player all the way front sort of lock double, you know, and I just defined it. Hey, we're going to start standing player. You're there. Other player, you have both hands locked just below the glutes. You try and have good posture and we'll just start one knee up, one knee down. And we made it really simple where, hey, it's the attacker. I have two goals, hips on the floor for 3 seconds or chest to back for 3 seconds. Right? Because from that position, those are more or less your two major outcomes. And I'm just trying to guide my students' attention on like, hey, if I get here, what am I thinking? What am I focused on? Right? And then I had like basic sort of cues that I gave them. Hey, most important thing is don't sacrifice your posture, right? If it's failing, you have to find the transition. And if you don't, that's fine. You just got data on what sort of failed, right? For the defensive player, I made it really simple for their goals. First thing, if they can just disengage to a standing neutral or at least It doesn't even have to be disconnected, but just a standing neutral. If we disconnect all of a sudden, now we're collar ties or we're hand fighting again for 3 seconds, that player has won, right? Or if they can create a chest-to-back situation, because obviously from there, you know, that's one of their easiest ways to improve that whole situation is for me to find a way to create a go-behind or maybe in a scramble, find my way there too. And the reason we sort of did it that way too is like for me as the attacker, if their goal is to disengage, it also helps me get chances to get that urgency to either reshoot or reattack, right? Which is something I want to create in my students, like to hunt a person down, right? But then it also is just going to give us those that whole next engagement of, you know, because we started super connected and sure we're playing here, but it's going to give you that chance now to play that next scramble, which is like the important scramble in some ways. And it was a really simple thing. So we started there. And then after, you know, I usually do straight time. So like Josh for a minute straight, little rest, Jake for a minute straight. And then we'll either usually right away, we'll play the same game immediately, but now it's a 2 minute round, offense, defense switches every time. So now there's like the pain or defeat because you lose your turn on offense, right? Now I got to defend this again. Then like what we did yesterday is like, great. So now we're going to play a game where you can, where the goal is to wrestle up. So I actually changed to, hey, now we're going to play a seated player versus a standing player. Okay. And standing player, we made it really simple. Their goal was to get chest to back and of course, keep the seated player down. But I added one restriction. They couldn't use their hands against their partner's lower body. So they couldn't affect the legs of the bottom player when they were playing seated guard, right? So of course, this sort of led to them doing a lot of posting, collar ties, posting on the shoulder, things like that, which I know are sort of one of the opportunities that a seated player is going to look to wrestle up, clear a post, get under those posts, things like that. So that was our first game that we played there. And the seated player was just trying to stand or get to a wrestle up, whether that means it collected one leg, both legs. All I wanted them to is come up by attacking the legs to put the partner on their hips. Or again, create chest to back, because that's what's going to happen when you try and put someone on their hips and they don't want to be there. So then that was sort of the game that we progressed it to. So we moved away from the connection, right? We weren't all the way in a locked double, and we moved somewhere now. Okay. Oh, here's this whole exchange that creates it. Cause it ends up being the same shape. If I wrestle up into a locked double, or if we're on our feet and I get to a locked double from then on, it's the same. And I was just trying to give them like opportunity to play with like context where they can now experience that. Right. Cause if the top player can attack their legs and lift the feet and stuff, I'm going to avoid wrestling up. It's going to be much harder. So it's sort of like easy mode, right? And then later on in the session, we took all the constraints off the top player and they're just trying to get chest to chest pins or chest to backs. And it sort of allowed like a stepping stone effect, but it's not the same as like when I was talking earlier about being like really regressive in nature, where we go like slice by slice of a small exchange. Right. Yeah, so that's just a little insight into how I planned like a portion of yesterday's session.
No, that's really helpful, especially to see using that connection as the spectrum and slowly backing out from there. If you were to keep backing out, where would you take them next?
Man, so what we actually did is, okay, so when I'm thinking of my session, I'm also considering my students' energy output. So all of that was just a gang of energy. Right? All this wrestling, all this scrambling, especially because we're so urgent on like hip highs, like get off the floor. So then we went all the way to sort of the opposite end of the spectrum. And we were going to like a straight Ashi type thing. We were playing a control versus escape game where it was very simple. Bottom player was trying to just maintain any attachment to the leg. So long as they had one leg under control, they're doing good. Top player was trying to either get to a weighted foot, meaning the leg that's strapped is flat on the floor, or the sole of that foot is flat on the floor with weight for 3 seconds, extract the leg all together, or create chest to back exposure. Reason I chose those things as a leg locker, those are the three things that if those start happening, my likelihood goes way down, right? If they get to a weighted foot, I can't break, right? If they can stand, their hips are on the floor, much harder, right? If they can get chest to back, I could, but I could also get Felipe painted and stuff there too, you know? So it's like we started there as a game, and then we added, hey, breaking for the bottom player. And we just went through that. And then I actually went back to a seated versus standing scenario, And we played the same constraint for the top player where they couldn't attack the legs, but bottom player, your goal is now broader. Put their hips on the floor, right? Or stand up. But we sort of show them, hey, two ways you generally put hips on the floor from the guard. We either wrestle up to put hips on the floor, or we get under to put hips on the floor. So then they were like looking at like entering into some of those entanglement situations because they were just there in the pure leg lock game. Because when their partner tried to get up to a weighted foot, they already saw that slice of the game and were working to off balance people back down to where they wanted. So then this let me sort of tie it all together back to that guarded scenario. And that was sort of just last night's session and how we ran with it.
Wow. Yeah, I can see why coaches are hesitant to adopt this because it is a lot of work designed. That's a very thoughtful and intentional way to design just a session. So now if you were to keep progressing this, you know, in tomorrow's session, let's say, and you wanted to work on wrestling, what would the future games look like with less connection?
Yeah.
So
for me, in a week, I'll usually stick around the same sort of games because they're pretty sound. What is going to change is who you do it with, right? And I've talked about this a little bit where sometimes we like we'll change partners a lot more, or we'll spend more time maybe on one game and just play it with way more different bodies, you know, things like that. So I'll usually stick with that same sort of progression, but like things will change. For example, my first week where I did the wrestling games, we never did the seated wrestle up. We did a lot of rounds from locked doubles because I really wanted people to like want to go there, to be like, oh man, when you get there, it's just chef's kiss. You know, that was like the thought process. So then the next week we actually scaled back from there in a sense, and that we did a little bit there. And then we did, hey, a place where you can get there so you can like appreciate it more. So that was sort of like from the week one to week two progression in that sense. And like same thing for like the leg locks. Week one, we played the same first game and there was a lot more. Then there was a second game really big on breaking. Whereas in week two, we didn't really do the game on breaking. I switched into that wrestle up game where either we wrestle up or we get under, because it was just a way to stack on the same idea, but in a slightly different context.
Right. And what would week three look like if you were to back it up?
I'm already on. I'll already be somewhere else. I only do 2 week blocks. I do 2 week blocks, usually 2-3 sort of core focus areas that I want to try and have as an outcome.
Yeah.
So for us, just looking like I have a spreadsheet, my next like 2 week block standing is going to be a lot more on like standing neutral skills. So getting either to locked hands, lifted leg, or hands on the mat. Sort of my big like 3 signposts, if I want to think of on the feet, what we're trying to create in a partner. And then we have some reverse de la Riva type stuff, just playing against that person, you know, and I think we'll probably end up tying it back into wrestle ups and getting underneath people. So there will be, you know, a little bit of a thread there, but that's just like the common thread of playing guard and jiu-jitsu, right? So some of those things overlap in that sense.
Gotcha. So you know how in sports sometimes in like high school, someone will win the most improved award, which is kind of like a nice way of saying you sucked in the beginning and you've got a little better. What is your most improved game? Like what game did you start with that's like, oh man, this one could use a lot of work, but it actually got a lot better over time as you improved it?
Let's see. Man, so I would say broadly, like, a lot of my guard games improved because in the beginning I was still like overly particular, and I found that was just making it hard for people to do anything that well, right? Where now, like any guard game that I set up, we pretty much have the same things we're trying to focus on. I'm just setting people up with like different attachments and then running the same sort of principles. But then like within that, I started to do a lot more of constraining a player, like how, hey, can't touch the legs, little things like that to help in that sense. So that's something I've been playing with more, whereas I wasn't really taking tools away from people so much as making the fight very narrow, so that of course, you know, either it's really stacked my favor, I didn't have to take anything away from the defensive player. It's just the odds are already stacked so hard that the offensive player had the likelihood to win, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas now I find, just as a general thing that I play with more, is I'm not going to stack the odds in that sense, but I'm just going to create something where you could for sure win. It's very likely you could win, but you're going to give this other person a lot of opportunities just by the nature that I'm sort of guiding you to win. And while I know that's not like one game, it's just sort of like the idea that I've started to implement more and more, just because I've seen a huge amount of benefit from that. Because biggest thing we see in jiu-jitsu students a lot of times is they just don't pull the trigger. So if I can make it a little bit easier for you to pull the trigger, especially in more chaotic like guard exchanges, it's way easier. Because like I find a lot of poor guard play is indecision, right? Not taking an action, not going for it, or not recognizing what to go for. So that's been just like an overall improvement I've been making to the way I try and structure and deliver some of those practice activities.
Yeah, I got feedback from someone I was trying to pass his guard, and he at the end of the session, he said, "Hey, you actually got to some decent positions, but then I think you were surprised that you got there and then you didn't know what to do after." So that resonates with me a lot. Can you, so that's generally with the guard games, they've improved a lot. Can you give an example of in the beginning when you'd make it way too complex, and then a now follow up example of like one of your cleanest guard games that you like to play?
Yeah. Whew, let's see. Cause I'm trying to think, like, I feel like my guard games have now gotten them the most open out of them all, because it is sort of the nature of that situation. Man, that is hard. Let's see. If I were to think of it, it would be sort of stuff like the situation where it's probably improved the most is a situation like a half guard scenario, where the top player, we had really like simple, easy goals, which I thought were like awesome. Where like, hey, you win if you can like be able to get upper body chest to chest, which was cool, right? And we set it up. But then eventually it led to like the bottom player just trying to defend things like that. You know, like, oh, I'm just going to make sure that I keep this really crappy frame in the whole time, because that's not chest to chest, you know, and things like that, which weren't really conducive to what I wanted them to be getting out of it. So now, like, you know, a lot of those things have changed. It's like, I realized like, it's not just chest to chest that I want. I need a pin to be happening. I need shoulders pinned here, or I need hips pinned here. And I think sometimes that was sort of like the refinement is like, it's actually mostly a lot of the same games, just the language I use around describing what I want them to be focused on. Cause you know, pinning a person in half guard is the actual thing we want, because chest to chest by itself doesn't really matter. Some guys love that stuff because you're chest to chest, and now you just gave them a free scoop grip on the leg because whatever, right? So it wasn't really the same thing. So that was like probably the way that I would think of like the same game evolved, was just by the way of what I really targeted their attention on. Because I, you know, you see the shortcoming game, like, I know that sucks and he's chest to chest, but this guy is still on his side and he's digging in there, or he has a great butterfly hook now. Like, it's cool that you're chest to chest. He got some free upper body attachments out of it too. You know, those are like sort of realizations that I have over time just playing with that.
Right. And as you go, you clarify, it sounds like you're clarifying the win condition, like the definition of the win condition, getting closer to what we're really looking for, what effect we're really trying to have.
Yeah. More and more. Before it used to be like, get this set of connections, right? Whereas now it's like, create this effect in your partner's body is what really matters, right? And I think that is a common thing to sort of run into early on, or even just like still, like, because now I guess we're like 18 months 20 months in, and we flip like all of our things. So each week we have like 25 sessions across all our different age groups and programs. So now we've really racked it up where that's a lot more of what we focus on and what we want to try and create.
Yeah. That is such a good like nugget in this conversation. I just want to repeat it again. So now you're more emphasizing the effect that you want them to have, not how it looks. What was it that you said?
Yeah, it's like, I don't really care about like the connections that they use. Like before, that was the big thing, right? But now it's like, what is the effect you create in the person? Because before it's very much get to this place, but you can get to a place and not be doing the right thing. Right, which we all know, because you've seen people who have things in the right place, but it's not doing what it's supposed to do. So rather than focusing on, hey, get to these connections or get to this like this condition of chest to chest, That is descriptive and it's helpful, but really what I want to guide them to is the effect that they create in the other player. Right. Because then it's whatever tool that is appropriate, because the tool will change. If I have a giant dude and I need to pin his shoulder to slat, I might be using way different things than I will on a smaller guy or a longer guy or a stockier, you know, just all that stuff. So that tool that I was really like overemphasizing might not be appropriate. And then I sort of ended up doing the same thing where I'm like, hey, this is the way. The way to do it is always reverse cross face and then elbow dig, find that, you know, like, no. The way is whatever. Hey, there's tools, you know, we can talk about them, but yeah.
Yeah. So if someone was listening to this and they're like, all right, I'm going to try to make a game tonight and practice it with a training partner. Where would you have them start? Like what instructions would you give them to experiment with for their first game?
Yeah. So usually what I like to think of is there's like two things that I try and like broadly when it comes to like three categories of games. Okay. One is going to be games where I want to create some sort of precursor that I know happens before something good. So for example, if I'm playing a mount escape game, it might be a continuous game where my goal is as often as I can get the top player's knee off the floor, because I know that's a precursor to escaping the mount in most situations, or, you know, like something like that, where I'm very focused on a precursor. Or it might be like a seated butterfly type scenario game where I'm focusing on as often as I can get their hand on the mat, force them to step up or put their head to the floor. Because I know those things are usually the start of awesome things from that sort of offensive position, right? So that's sort of one place you might start. The other sort of place is like, hey, if I have a great connection, how can I improve that connection one level up? So, you know, we'll think of something like a side close, side scissor, whatever you want to call it. Maybe we'll start there and we'll play a game where, okay, your whole goal from here is to get hips connected to their shoulders. So that might be you're climbing up, attacking arm bars or whatever, right? Or be able to use that all the way to get control of their hips and their shoulders, which could be you come up and you take the back, or you reverse them and you take them out, right? So we look at, let's start here and think of that next sort of like physical dominant thing we want to try and do, because that's a really simple way to play from, right? And then the middle sort of one, which I think sometimes can be a little bit more tricky because you have to like not really know jiu-jitsu, is like you play from a control scheme and you play sort of like denial, sort of like that leg lock game I was talking about, where hey, we're going to play in on the legs, stay attached to whatever leg you need to. We're trying to make sure these things don't happen, and you just try and rack up as much time in that can be sort of tricky, but it can also be really easy, you know, for those positions you're good at. You already know those things, you can really create something that'll help you emphasize those. So those are sort of the three ways that I sort of think of how might I create like a practice activity with the goal of this.
Yeah, that is super helpful. I need to go back and take some notes and just start playing with that. Now switching gears a bit, how about for competition? Do you structure games differently? Do you have a competition team that you, or do you work with individuals and personalize the games that you would have them work on? Does that change anything at all?
So for us, I don't really have like a separate comp program, you know, because just thinking back to some things, hey, the real thing that happened in comp class was just a lot of rounds, a lot more live training, more of that, right? So that was one part, is hey, we have a lot. And like the other thing is I realize sometimes comp, yes, I get all the most committed people in the same room at the same time, but then sometimes I can do things where you don't get the right amount of bodies that you need that match up with you or things like that. So for me, actually, our school, everything is all levels. So white through black belt is in the same session. They're mixing it up. My competitors, my, you know, just people who are there having fun and kicking ass, you know, they're all in the same room. But there will be things where, you know, with those guys, I'm going to let them play the next scramble. You know, like I'll start to tell them, hey, if this goes to the next exchange, don't stop. Just win that exchange. Because there's no reason for example, on like for them in that seated versus standing game, I'm not going to make it stop as soon as the bottom player stands up anymore. You guys can fight that exchange until one of you gets that next advantage, whatever that is, because that's not really an advantage yet for you guys. Hey, you reset something, but what's next? You know, so that is more likely what I'm to do. But what I will do though, is I will have some guys who I know are competitors and they have something and I have some things that I really want them to focus on. And I might sort of guide what they want to do for their open mat time. Like, hey, try and play games like this because we really need to work on this wrestling engagement. Because, hey, you want to do trials. This is going to be super important. You need a disproportionate amount of touches on this area, you know, and that might be sort of what that looks like in terms of how I help those guys who have like very particular things. Or like we have a tournament coming up soon where, you know, it's sub only, but the overtime is always EBI backgrounds. So, of course, I'm going to try and, hey, you guys, if you're doing this, we got to be dialing in on these sort of games. And I'll huddle those guys up, try and play these rounds whenever you can.
Right. Now at the competition, it was on your podcast that I first heard the term joysticking. Can you describe what is that and what is an alternative way to coach from the sidelines?
Well, if you think of like joysticking, and here's the thing, like people do it because it sort of works in the very beginning when you have like super novices who don't know what to be doing. You can just be shouting ideas and it's useful. Right. But over time that becomes less useful. But essentially what it is when you're trying to play through with your voice, you know, it's you know, control their wrist, block their hand, you know, like scissors, like, man. Other one guy's like, okay, man, scissor sweep or cross choke, here we go. It's like, bro, you can't just say scissor sweep or cross choke. Like, that's not what's gonna happen, you know, like that isn't super useful for them. And then also what happens to your athlete is suddenly they're tunnel vision on just trying to do the things you're just shouting, you know, like almost flatter now. It's like, bro, the moment has already gone, right? By the time your words were out, everything has changed, you know? So it's sort of this idea where you're calling exactly what you want them to do at all times. And it's just not super effective. It can be, you know, I had some like, but the only times I've ever seen that really work well is when it's like the guy that I'm coaching is like my primary training partner. And, you know, I know everything he's thinking and feeling and he's playing there. But the truth is most coaches probably don't have that with 80% of their athletes, maybe 90% of their athletes. They don't have that level of familiarity where you really know what they're thinking, what they're feeling in a lot of situations. Right. So instead, you're just button mashing, hoping that it'll work out because of what you think is going on. Now, my coaching is a lot more like focus based. You know, I had like a student recently, they're competing. And all I was saying is in the closed guard, we just need to make sure he can't post on you. Just constantly focus on his hands. Don't allow him to post on your body, right? Remember, it's the hands. We're either passing them outside, inside, but just like, it's more so calling their focus to what that key slice of the fight is, right? And I knew for him, man, if this guy can't post on, he can't do anything. And now we can start working our offense and building it from there. So I find the way that I coach is a little bit different in that sense. Because, yo, I was a hardcore joysticker, like MVP of joysticking louder than the other coach. Me, for sure. Now I'm just louder than the other coach, but I'm saying better stuff.
Right. That's interesting because, yeah, the joysticking seems to be like you're trying to have them do a particular technique or particular move versus shine a spotlight on this general effect that you're trying to have or have them prevent, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wow. I just love that term, joystick. It's the perfect word to describe that situation.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Here's maybe the last question, but is there, I just wanted to ask someone in the eco world this, is there an eco way to learn eco?
Man, you know, like, sure, fuck around and find out. But, you know, I usually what I recommend is like I don't know. I think like, yes and no, because my coaches didn't read How We Learn to Move or any of those books or watch any of Souter's stuff, but they just started seeing like how I was coaching, playing around with it. So if you just want to like play games, you'll start to figure out like, oh, why is this a good game? You know, why was this a bad game? But I don't know if there's like a way. And it's funny because you'll see it like in like that eco Discord when people are talking about this, like everyone's constantly just, you know, a new iteration of the same thing. Like when you start, like my first game is way different than my last game. Just like that last lesson plan I talked to you, man, that lesson plan would smoke some of my earlier ones, you know, just because of my ability to tie things together. But a lot of it is like you have to learn to be you have to be watching way more, because I have to be seeing, hey, what did I say and what actually happened when I said that thing. So the real thing is you do have to get a lot of reps to get good at it, because sometimes it's hard to just do like a random session. I see this as like a big struggle for some people. It's like, I only get to coach one class a week, right? So they feel like, okay, I better, but it's hard to get good at coaching in a whole new way if you only get like one session a week and it's already, you know, sort of maybe pre-planned what the focus had to be on, or all these things that, you know, some coaches have because they don't have enough ownership or influence to be able to, you know, totally run with it. Didn't answer anything, but I think the big thing is you have to just get like the reps in. And I think really, like, you're not going to ruin someone's life if you make a bad practice activity. Like, the only people who knew my practice activity sucked was me. Same thing, like in everything, like when I bumble on a speech or something in life, the only person I knew I messed up was me. No one else had any idea. They were just happy to be there having fun, you know? Like, I think also it's just like perfectionism can stop people. Like, I need a perfect game. Like, you know, like even when I was talking with like Preet, he was like, oh, you know, we'd be like analyzing our practice by the minute. It's like, yeah. And then you realize, oh, I don't have to do that. It's okay if this is crap and this is great. We just iterate on it, you know, over and over.
Right. Jake, sorry, I've been steamrolling this conversation per usual, but wanted to check in with you and see if you had any questions you wanted to cover.
No, I really enjoyed it. I've been trying to make my own games. I never really listened to too much Greg or honestly any influence. I've just been trying to make my own stuff, and hearing the way you've gone about it is giving me some new angles to think about for sure. So I was taking some notes. And I'll be experimenting with it for sure. Yeah, one thing I was thinking about with the joystick thing. Basically, you like just trying to call your students like attention to the battle that you think like matters in that moment. I find myself like when a student like asks a question now, I'm trying to answer their question in that term, as opposed to like joysticking the answer to the question. Mm-hmm. Like, the answer to your question is like, put your right hand here. Or just like, don't say that. Like, the answer to the question, like, well, what was your like intention during that? Or like, where was your attention? Or what was your intention when you were doing like what you're doing? And then just try and like redirect their attention or attention, whichever you think was like wrong. And like, yeah, just having that like framework and kind of just like buying into that idea, I think helps just have like a better mindset when you're like coaching or teaching or whatever. Like, I think kind of like you said at the beginning, I think a lot of people are trying to apply like the old mindset in this like eco framework. Mm-hmm. And like direct people to like a specific technique, but that's just
that's like an interesting thing, you know, students asking questions. They're like, oh, here's exactly what you should do. And like, you got to like not catch yourself, because you won't ruin their life, because they came to you with a question, which is like a more appropriate time for explicit instruction. If there is, you know, once they have experienced a problem, that is a time where that type of more direct feedback makes sense. But it is also the great time to be like, hey, so like, what's happening here? Right. Or like, questioning is super good to be like asking them. But like, you know, I had people last night, it's like, hey, so like sometimes I'm super mounted, my arms overhead. What do I do to like get out of it? Like, I want to tell them like, hey, you know, just shoulder walk or whatever, you know, like whatever would be more preserved. But I have to be like, oh, so what's the problem here? It's like, well, you don't have your elbows between you and your partner anymore. Your elbows aren't, you know, acting as a frame. So we can either try and move them to get that back in or move ourselves. You know, we have to like, I think it's really good because it just lets you restate the problem to them. Like, oh yeah, that's what happened. So now they know a little bit urgent. Yeah. The urgent and the elbow line is so important here, or whatever it is, you know, like right. We were teaching guillotine escapes because people had questions after class. Like, oh, you know, you just need to think of like these couple things, because if they can understand the mechanic, I find a lot of my answers to like little questions, like, hey, what are the mechanics here? Like, what are they trying to do? How does that work? And then you're like, figure it out, or we'll troubleshoot our workshop it together, you know. But yeah, that is an interesting thing. Jake, question for you. Do you find people have better questions for you when they come up to you?
100%. It's awesome. And like, Yeah. Even like people who've been training for like 6 years will ask me questions. And the people who have been training for like 2 weeks, I'm like, that 2 week question was like a more like well thought out question, you know, than like the 6 year person asking a question. It's very interesting.
Yeah. I think it's just that the way that they've engaged with jiu-jitsu is totally different. They weren't playing move for move, right? Where like you pull up your next card, I sort of have my next card. It's not like that, you know? There's so much time just under there. I'm like, ah, what's the problem? I love the
And I do find like a lot of them, at least like the recent ones, have been definitely taking more like ownership of their like learning, because they'll come and they'll say like, hey, I was trying to do this, but it wasn't working, and like they were escaping like this, and then I like tried solve the this problem, you know. It's like they didn't necessarily come to me when they failed once. They've like tried a couple more things to solve the problem.
Yeah,
you know, I just think that's pretty cool.
Yeah I love it.
Do you play any of the games during class, or do you just watch?
When I coach, I only coach.
When I first started, I like really liked it because it was basically just like a bunch of positional sparring was the way I was kind of thinking about it. And like I could just like explain a situation and then I could jump in instead of having to walk around and like correct little mistakes people were making on techniques. But then I wasn't able, I felt like my games weren't the best back then. My practices weren't the best. But I also got to participate in them. So for my own like improvement, I enjoyed it. But now kind of the way I've been going about it is all like make a game kind of like you. Like I tend to play like the same games for like a few classes. And once I kind of like make a game, make some like iterations of it, and I think like it's working well after like sitting back and surveying the land, then I'll maybe hop in like the next day kind of thing. Like once I know it's like operating relatively smoothly. But yeah, I don't get to train too often. Like I only get to coach like a lot of times, which is kind of annoying. So I kind of like to train myself.
Yeah. What I have done, cause like, you know, my like assistant coach in the session, he's going to want to hop in at some point too. And even I would like to, that's where like changing the way the game is delivered. Hey, so you do it with a partner, you do it in a small group, you do it in a King of the Hill Shark Tank style, you know, those will give you, because by then everyone already got enough of like direct touches and like that intense focus time, that switching up and adding all that variability of partners is the perfect time for you to come in. Because now also you coming into the mix is super valuable for them, because it's a whole new thing to interact with, right? And just that's part of the part of our whole focus is giving them like touches and experience. Like the way I've always thought of this is like, I don't know if you ever played like Madden or those games, like just bumping up a character's like awareness points in one area. That's all I think of. It's like, I'm just trying to bump up their awareness here, you know, like boom. So the more people they touch, the better it is for that.
That's exactly what we do actually. It's like, you know, winner stays in and then loser kind of just like cycles out. And yeah, that's exactly what we do.
Yeah, and it's a great way, especially if you're itching to get in there and that's the only time you can really be on there. Because then you're not jacking anyone's practice, you know? It's just adding to it at that point.
Right.
Kabir, do you have a favorite coaching moment from this last year and a half?
Oh, dude, actually, yes. A little bit recently, and it was just so we just recently started this wrestling stuff, like probably December-ish, we really started adding it in as being one of our big focus in the games. And I get like, I have some pretty like new guys who are pretty big, athletic, really good. And I have like an older guy who's probably like 45, 50. And for him to like hit doubles in live training on this guy, but also like chain stuff when he hit the first line of defense and stuff like that, I'm like, damn, you just manhandled this guy that's a giant athlete. And that was sick, you know, just seeing those type of moments where I'm like, oh cool. Because like I think that's one thing just universally that's really been cool, is I see students be more like chaining attacks and really trying to like hunt people down, which is awesome. That's like my favorite thing. And for that, I was like, whoa, I didn't expect that. Because it was funny. I was telling one of our other coaches, like, man, you didn't believe it. Like, they took him around. Like, of course, that guy took him down. He's like a driver. I'm like, no. It was the other way. It was the other way. He got him. And he's like, oh, sick. You know? Yeah, just stuff like that is always good, you know? Because that's actually, like, for me, honestly, like, what is, like, my least athletic guy's jiu-jitsu growth look like? You know, everyone who like usually would be like not your favorite training partner, you know, like people are like, oh, you know, people are like, oh, those old guys just like hold you still and do nothing. Like you see it all the time where people like have that criticism, like, man, I've like gotten that out of them. They're loose. They're playing. They're chasing, you know, and that's been a really big like thing I enjoy.
That's awesome. And before we let you go, Kabir, where can people find more about you or say hi or follow the journey? Yeah.
Man, easiest thing is just my Instagram. It's just my full name, at Kabir Bath. Connect with me there. Yeah, I would say it's the best place because I'm still figuring out what I want to do with everything else. So if you go there, you'll be able to see what my most recent thing, like me making those coaching conversations, total accident. Who knows what my next happy little accident will be, but if it comes up, it'll be on there.
Yeah, sounds good. Thank you so much for your time today. We dove pretty deep, so this is one I'm going to have to re-listen to and experiment with. So I appreciate your help along the way. And yeah, everyone out there listening, thank you so much for listening. Hope you enjoy this one. And we'll probably have a lot more eco-style conversations along the way because this is the new obsession. So
awesome. Thanks so much for having me.